AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
AP News, I'm Ben Thomas. Democrats are celebrating their 51-49 Senate majority following Raphael Warnock's win in the Georgia runoff.
Georgia did it again.
As Warnock returned to the Capitol, he was greeted outside by Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who hours earlier couldn't stop smiling after the longest evenly split Senate in modern times.
It gives us just a lift.
An end to the days where just one Democrat could snarl legislation. The outright majority will also make simple governing easier and allow Senate Democrats to be a barrier against legislation from the GOP-led House. Schumer figures the Democrats' unexpectedly strong midterm showing sent a message to Trump-inspired Republicans.
That if they follow a MAGA direction, they're going to lose.
And says he'll reach across the aisle to deliver on bipartisan promises. Sagar Meghani at the White House.
Elsewhere in Washington, Jessica Gresko reports the Supreme Court heard a case from North Carolina.
An attempt by North Carolina's Republican-led legislature to draw U.S. House districts in favor of GOP candidates.
State courts struck down the new map. How did the justices see it?
What those of us in the courtroom thought we heard was both liberal and conservative justices skeptical of making a broad ruling in this case.
Peru's Congress has ousted President Pedro Castillo. He's been arrested on a charge of rebellion after he sought to dissolve the Congress. Russian President Vladimir Putin is acknowledging his special military operation in Ukraine is taking longer than expected. And Rita Foley has news on Ukraine's President Vladimir Zelensky.
Time magazine says President Zelensky and the spirit of Ukraine are Time's 2022 Person of the Year for reminding the world of the fragility of democracy and of peace.
This is AP News.
Girls and boys in poverty around the world are dreaming of a better life filled with dance, art, music, and knowledge. They dream of a brighter future with enough nutritious food to eat, a chance to learn and grow, to get an education, escape poverty, and do incredible things. Today, thanks to Children International and friends like you, such dreams are coming true. Together, we give children a chance to set their sights high and succeed in school and in life by ensuring that they have access to healthcare, education, life skills, and so much more so they can grow, thrive, and believe in themselves. Learn more about Children International and join us in our life-changing work at children.org today. Together, we can help end poverty for good.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
This local musical interlude is brought to you by Max Inc. Radio. Dana Perry. Listen to Max Inc. Radio every Saturday and Sunday, 6 p.m. to midnight. Download the podcast at maxincradio.com. We are local music.
Speaker Voss, I understand you don't have any children. Does that mean he's been possibly practicing
sex with
contraceptives?
What?
Or is he just less than a man? How do you go through the entire life, three wives later, and no chitlins?
Shooting blanks?
Perhaps.
Pull and pray.
Doubtful.
Not getting any.
Unlikely.
Unable to perform.
More likely.
Paying for it.
I hate to judge.
We don't judge here. We're the Devil's Advocate.
Listen to the Devil's Advocates live weekdays from 3 to 6 p.m.
Hey, this is Jim Santel. I am the host of Morning Cannolis. Every single Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., we talk about the major stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Delighted to have you join, call in, and be a part of our discussion right here on the networks of Civic Media.
Telling my girls about my Alzheimer's diagnosis was hard.
But Mom's early detection gave us time to make a plan.
Talk to your family about seeing a doctor. Go to alz.org/time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
For Civic Media, I'm Terry Bell with this news. A second death is now linked to the man in Racine police call the dating app predator. Police found a body inside a home where Timothy Olson used to live. Olson is under investigation for the death of a South Milwaukee woman. Olson is in jail on an unrelated kidnapping charge. A new invasive fungus called tar spot is devastating corn crops across the Midwest. Scientists believe the disease originated in Central America and was brought here by tropical weather in 2015. The disease penetrates the leaf surface and kills the corn. In sports, defensive coordinator Jim Leonard says he'll leave the Wisconsin football program after the Guaranteed Rate Bowl on the 27th. Wisconsin and Marquette were both winners in men's college basketball last night. The Bucks host Sacramento tonight. You're listening to The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM.
Never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at TheRickSmithShow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So back in October of 2020, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf signed Act 85 into law. And what that did was it created a joint task force to look at employee misclassification. Well, they've come out with a report. They've got a they did their due diligence. This seven-person bipartisan commission, this task force, they came out with their report. And what'd they find? Well, they found what we already knew. Misclassification is costing us a lot of money. It's harming workers. It's giving employers a benefit that is costing taxpayers, costing workers, especially injured workers. And it's, well, not great. I'm here to share some thoughts on just how bad this is. I've asked John Mattia to come talk with us. John is the state legislative director for the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Teamsters.org, the website, if you want to check out the work that they're doing there. John, thanks for taking time for us.
No problem. Good to be with you, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. So I'm looking at these numbers and, you know it's bad, but when you look at the numbers, you know, staring you in the eye, 11,670 workers estimated injured on the job denied workers' compensation because they were misclassified. You look at the numbers, you know, almost 400,000 workers misclassified at almost 50,000 employers. This is a big problem, harming working people and taxpayers as well.
Yeah, there's no doubt that this task force identified the problem. They identified the problem. Now, they were legislatively referred by the Republican legislature at the time and the Democratic governor to figure out the answer to the question. But now the question for all of us and for working people is, when these recommendations go to the General Assembly next year, are the lawmakers there? Are they interested in the answer? Because you know, Rick, that unfortunately, when it comes to legislative work, sometimes the easiest way to kick a can down the road is to create a study on something or create a task force on something.
Right.
But I want to give you some hope here too. Because again, you mentioned it, that this task force is bipartisan. There's a representative on here from the Republicans in the House. There's a representative from the Dems in the House. There's a representative from the Republicans in the Senate and from the Dems in the Senate. And then an appointee from the Attorney General's office, the Department of Labor and Industry, as well as the Department of Revenue. So a truly bipartisan full look at this. They looked at it. They put this together throughout 2021. And in 2022, they released this preliminary report. And in Pennsylvania, the Teamster leadership there, led by Bill Hamilton at the Pennsylvania Conference of Teamsters, he assembled a team, including myself, to take a look at this thing and figure out, okay, this is what the task force put together. We see the results, we see the numbers, but what were these recommendations that these task force members are going to put to the lawmakers? So we dug into it, we looked at it, And there's some good news and there's some bad news. The good news is that the task force.
Let's start with the good news.
Yeah, we'll start with the good news. The good news is the task force correctly identified a lot of the problems that we're seeing. And you mentioned the numbers, but they recognize that when misclassification happens, that workers are being robbed.
Right. So when you talk about misclassification, let me stop you here. When you talk about that, what are we talking about misclassification? What's the definition that they used? I've used the definition. What definition did they go by?
So what they're looking at is oftentimes it's intentional, as you know, by employers. They're doing this on purpose. But these are situations where under what is called an ABC test, and we'll get into that in a second, but under normal kind of fair circumstances, these workers should be employees of an employer. But the employer, like I said, usually intentionally, is classifying them as an independent contractor. So you see this in companies all over the place. You see them in some of the most profitable companies out there. You see it in places like Amazon. You see it in places like Uber and Lyft. And there's been a lot of attention and news on Uber and Lyft specifically. And with the ABC test, which is one of the recommendations from the task force, what that says is that it's a three-part test. To be an independent contractor, you've got to pass all of these. Right. So the A is that the worker is free from the control of the employer, that they're free to do the work the way they want to do it. Now, if you think about the Amazon delivery drivers, which a lot of people think are Amazon employees, they're not. They work for a series of hundreds or even thousands of, so-called independent subcontractors. But they have to wear the Amazon clothes. They have to drive an Amazon van. They have to deliver the package exactly how Amazon wants. They can be disciplined based on if they don't. So it doesn't sound like they're under much control, being their own boss, right, at that DSP, which is the delivery service partner, the name of these organizations. So that's A. I mean, that's failed. B, number two, is that the worker would have to perform work outside the usual course of the employer's business. So if you take Uber and Lyft with this example, Uber and Lyft, their whole business model is delivering, whether it's food or people, from one location to another. That's the business model. That's what it is. The drivers doing this, the workers doing this, are not doing anything outside the usual course of the employer's business entity. They're right in the framework of what the employer is doing. And then number three, the C of the ABC test, is that the worker is engaged in other business aside from that company. So again, using the Uber and Lyft model, if it truly was an independent contractor, they'd have their own business doing this for on their own, setting their own routes, doing that kind of stuff. That's not what happens. They have to take direction from Uber or Lyft, how the routes are done, what the costs are going to be. They have no say in any of that. So that's the ABC test. That is a recommendation coming from this group, from a bipartisan group, which is impressive
because there are a lot of businesses out there that, I can think of off the top of my head right now that, they have people who are considered gig workers, independent contractors, however you want to frame them, who they direct in every way, shape, or form. They tell them what they have to do, where they have to do it, how they have to do it, when they have to do it, in the manner they have to do it, wear the uniform, slap the logo on the vehicle, all of this stuff, but they're their own boss, which has always been very curious to me and why our law allows the loophole in this. So I'm kind of surprised to hear this task force identifying this as one of the solutions. What are the chances of that actually getting through?
Well, like I said, whether or not the General Assembly, they ask the question, but do they want the answer? And if they get the answer, which we know what it is, and we're seeing it right now, what are they going to do with that? And a lot of that depends on what lawmakers are going to be there in November. But if I may, if you don't mind, I'd like to just explain a little bit about this DSP, what I mentioned, this Amazon model, because the one blind spot, the big blind spot in this task force's recommendation, this is what a couple of weeks ago we presented to the task force itself, was that, look, the ABC test, the other provisions in the recommendations, the stop work orders, that would be in place for companies that misclassify. That is all good stuff. Those are all things that we support and that we will support if that makes it across the street there in Harrisburg to the General Assembly. But it does not address this other form of misclassification, what we can call, just for shorthand here, the DSP model. So what DSPs are in the Amazon world are delivery service partners. These are the so-called independent businesses that Amazon contracts with to actually do the deliveries. So the workers who are actually delivering packages to people's doors, they are not independent contractors themselves. They're employees of this DSP. However, Amazon is dictating to the DSP what they wear, what routes they take, how they deliver the package, how they take the picture of the package when it's at your house, all that stuff. So our recommendation and our argument to the task force is, look, this DSP owner himself or herself is a employee of Amazon. This is not an independent business. This is an employee of Amazon. This is a middle person, between Amazon and these drivers. So they should be captured under the definition of what is an employee in this recommendation. If that were to happen, then everybody underneath would also become considered, would also be considered employees. And so that was our recommendation. And while this task force, a preliminary report is out there, our direct ask to the task force is that there's still a final version coming this fall. And we think, and I think you agree with us, Rick, is that whatever the task force is putting to the lawmakers in Harrisburg should be the highest standard possible. We know that that may not be what it looks like at the end of the day when the lawmakers get through with it. Hopefully it is. But if it isn't, we need to be starting at the absolute top, the absolute best recommendations possible.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with John Mattia. He's State Legislative Director for the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. We're talking about employee misclassification, Pennsylvania's task force report on Act 85 and some of the stuff coming out of that. Now, these providers, these DSPs, as you call them, this isn't new, is it? I mean, we've seen, FedEx has got kind of this model. We've got a bunch of this stuff from the past that people have, I'm an entrepreneur. I have, I'm willingly going into this. What's the difference between them? I mean, this is kind of, now Amazon's doing it on a much larger scale, but why does this matter to the consumer?
Well, partly is two parts. One is why it matters to the consumer. I'll get to that in a second. The first one, how it's a little bit different, is that these contracts between DSPs and Amazon are very hard to get a hold of, number one. We do have some that have been part of legal proceedings. But what these DSPs, and under these contracts, they're required to have policies on employment at will in the contract. They're under the contract, Amazon is involved in the worker background checks and reserves and controls the discretion to fire workers for almost any reason. Amazon sets the routes, as I said. DSPs cannot, under these contracts, issue press releases about Amazon work without the company's permission. And then Amazon is specifically indemnified, which is a legal word, but it's basically preventing them from having any liability over death or injury to these DSP workers. And what's a little bit different is that the DSP models under these contracts can only do work for Amazon. With some of the FedEx examples of the past, they may have been subcontractors that were doing work for different other employers, not just FedEx. They are only to be able to do work for Amazon. So if, for example, the DSP workers feel like they want to organize a union, or if there are too many workers' comp claims coming out of a DSP where there's higher injury rates, which is a major problem, Amazon, what can they do? You know the answer, right? They can cut that off and just take that work to another DSP. There's hundreds of them, thousands of them. So that's what makes it a little bit different. And why is it important to Teamster members? Why is it important to the public at large? Is because Amazon has been growing for, 10 years, but the 15 years, even longer than that. But this pandemic has exponentially grown Amazon. And it by allowing them, by the government allowing them to get away with this, it is putting pressure on all these other employers who are now at a competitive disadvantage. So it's not just, it is a worker issue. Don't get me wrong. I mean, that's why we're in this fight, but it's a business issue too. And we hope, I mean, I hope that is why the recommendations out of this are so strong. And we hope that we can make that case. And hopefully there are some business people that will help make that case in Harrisburg to the lawmakers to say, look, this is a worker issue for sure, but employers doing the right thing here are getting penalized because we're allowing, we being, you know, the government and our elected officials are allowing them to get away with this.
Yeah, I mean, this is the ultimate race to the bottom. And, you know, anytime you see this kind of scenario where you've got, you know, the worker who's, I've always loved the, you know, I spent most of my time in the freight industry and I watched what happened to the freight industry as we went to, you know, everyone's their own boss. So they were doing lease ops and they were doing all these things. And what ends up happening in these scenarios is the worker ends up being the one shouldering all the responsibilities, all the costs, and not reaping the rewards. So for me, the message out of this for working people is this isn't what you want. Because if you allow them it to happen to these workers, eventually it's going to be all of us stuck in these kind of gimmicks and these schemes to where we're no longer working for these big companies. We're all our own boss being cheated and exploited. And at some point that's got to stop, I think.
Right. Rick, we dove into, because we presented this in Harrisburg to the task force, we really delved into the Harrisburg area to do a comparison between UPS, which are Teamster members, versus these DSP drivers. And UPS drivers around the Harrisburg area make $40 or more per hour in base wages. They receive full benefits, an employer-paid health insurance, fully employer-paid, employer-funded defined benefit pension. I can tell you that on the DSP side, they're not getting a pension. If they are getting any health insurance, it's super expensive that they're paying for. They suffer industry-leading high injury rates, and they're making $15 to $20 an hour. They're making half of what our members of UPS are making. And UPS is doing just fine. They're making billions of dollars. You can make money and workers can organize and form a union and have a voice and have a contract. It's possible. It is possible.
It is possible, but the CEO and the owner of UPS, I don't see them being shot into space.
Right. Right. And I mean, our general president, Sean O'Brien, you've probably seen him say this. He calls Amazon and their ilk white collar crime syndicates. And this is exactly what he's talking about when he says that. This intentional misclassification is robbing workers. It's hollowing out communities because, Rick, if all those UPS workers, if all those other jobs become $15 an hour jobs, all the communities we live in and the Pennsylvanians live in across the state, those communities are going to look very different.
Yeah.
Very different.
So last question I've got for you then, how do we make sure that this moves? Because, look, I have my view that, while this is a bipartisan commission, I don't expect a lot from the Republicans in moving a pro-worker agenda. But this is where I ask my Republican friends, reach out to your members, reach out to candidates, get their thoughts, get them on board with this. But how do we get this pushed through? How do we make this a reality so that the dignity of work is rewarded, that people have respect on the job? And when you work for an employer, you actually work for that employer.
Right. Well, we're actually in a good time to make this case right now, Rick, because we're getting into election season. So ideally, this is the time where lawmakers, they should be listening to their constituents all the time, but they are definitely listening when it comes to election time. And we need to get them on the record now as to what they think about this. We know this is coming. This is going to be coming to them at the end of this year. Everybody that's elected in Harrisburg in the Senate and the House are going to have this in front of them. And we need to make sure we're getting it in front of them. When it comes to the Teamsters and labor unions, we need to make sure we're getting this out to our members. They understand the issue, that they're understanding to reach out, whether they are a Republican or a Democrat. This, Rick, we have members that are Republicans and Democrats, independents. We got them across the board, and everybody needs to be out there talking about this. In addition to you know, the other legislative, you know, issues that that are in front of Pennsylvania, including autonomous vehicles and everything else, things that our members, when we get in front of them, they understand it. When you lead with the issues, they get it. They understand it.
There you go.
And we just have to make that case to them and then tie that into the candidate.
Good stuff. John, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Good stuff, as always. Look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thanks, sir.
Good stuff, John Mattia, State Director, Legislative Director for the IBT. Love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Where do you come down on this? I think we got to move. And if you work for a company, you should be working for that company. None of this, you're your own boss nonsense here. You take all the responsibility. You take all the risks. And they take all the benefits. But I'd like to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
Think Tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, ricksmithshow.com. So, you know, look, real quick, I want to go through that ABC test because I think that's important. Because I get a lot of people go, well, you know, I want to be an independent. I want to be my own boss. And look, a lot of people do. And that's great. Put your own shingle out. Do your own work. But not if you were an employee, you were supposed to be an employee. Now, like I use FedEx as the example because everyone knows who they are. They got to wear the outfit. They got to drive the truck that's got the name on it. They're told where to go, when to go, how to go, all that stuff. That's been well documented. They are not employees of FedEx. They work for a third-party logistics company. They work for someone else. This is the same thing with these DSPs. The people that you see wearing the Amazon costumes and driving the Amazon trucks, they don't actually work for Amazon. They work for a guy who hey, I'll take the contract and we'll go hire some people and Amazon gives them an amount per hour that they then have to go find people for. And you know, and then as John points out, what Amazon's doing is a lot different than what FedEx or what others have done in the enormous amount of detail that goes into all of the other stuff, the hiring practices, the discipline practices, all of the what you would say is that of an employer. But this idea that an actual independent contractor, and this is where people get screwed up on the ABCs, you've got to be self-directed. You've got to be able to do your job how you want it done, when you want to do it, how you want to do it. This idea, you take this here at this time, I go this route, and no, that's not, you're somebody else, you're at somebody else's behest. You're self-directed. Okay, I can do that tomorrow at this time, I can do this, whatever. It's got to be outside the scope of normal business. You can't do the job that someone else would have done. I had someone go, I work in a warehouse. Can they outsource me and bring in independent contractors? In this world, yeah. If someone's willing to go, yeah, I'll do it. I'll come do warehouse work for a day. That would be their argument. And the other part of it is you got to have other work. You can't just work for this one entity. That makes you an employee. And what's interesting to me is, and this is the part that I love when people go, well, I like the flexibility. I go, yeah, you don't have to give up the flexibility just because you're an employee. This is what contracts are about. You can negotiate, and we talked about this yesterday. You can negotiate contracts that have flexibility in it. You can negotiate contracts that give you the ability to be flexible, work different hours, work different schedules. You can do that. I've seen it. So interesting. I'm happy to see that the task force has this proposal. And it'll be interesting to me to see if Republicans will come along. Because historically, they have not been the party of the working class. Now, I know they're trying. They're trying to pivot.
The Shaw 101 FM, Brookfield's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
This local musical interlude is brought to you by Max Inc. Radio, VO5.
Let's do it on the dance hall. Let's do it.
Listen to Max Inc. Radio every Saturday and Sunday, 6 p.m. to midnight. Download the podcast at maxincradio.com. We are local music.
Hey, this is Jim Santel. I am the host of Morning Cannolis. Every single Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., we talk about the major stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Delighted to have you join, call in, and be a part of our discussion right here on the networks of Civic Media.
So all you folks out there, if you haven't register to vote, get ready to vote. There are so many things on the ballot this November, at our freedom, our liberty, and our way of life. But we'll get to all of that this evening.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m. on the Shaw 101 FM and WAUK 540 AM.
27% of the American workforce, and some even say 30%, were in unions who had representation and who clearly did not have to worry about whether or not they were going to get their fair share. But I'm definitely going to fight for people who get the short end of the stick in this society only because they don't have representation. That's who I am.
Check out the Earl Ingram Show every day from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. only on WAUK 540 AM, 101 FM, The Shaw.
Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian.
I'm really trying hard not to go insane from the mind screw that is this situation. Yes. With I was going to say the GAB, but now it's the WEC, which is audited by the LAB, and then it's now screwed up by the GOP, and we're all SOL. Good for us. Congratulations.
Look at all those acronyms. Yeah.
Oh. We're the winners.
Tune in for Dueling Tangents every weekday at 2.
Stories come to life at your local parks and forests. They're places of wonder, and they're closer than you think. Make the forest part of your story today at a local park near you, or find one at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matner with your headlines. An increasing number of high schoolers in Wisconsin are experiencing depression and anxiety. The 2021 Youth Risk Behavior Survey found nearly one-third of respondents, 33.7%, reported they felt sad or hopeless almost every day for more than 2 weeks. Among female students, the number 46.1%. Nearly one in five said they seriously considered attempting suicide, including 24.6% of female students, 8.5% of all respondents said they did attempt it one or more times in the year before the survey. The numbers especially concerning for lesbian, gay, and bisexual students. Nearly half of students in those groups who were surveyed, 48%, reported they seriously considered or attempted suicide. The survey taken on a voluntary basis in the fall of 2021. You're listening to The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK, 540 AM.
The Saudi golf tour won't wash off the regime's indelible ugliness, but four, it will boomerang on the money-grubbing golfers selling their once good names to it.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So John sent me this graph from the good folks over at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities that pointed out that, you know, back in the 1970s, And this is, you know, for all those people who go, we can't forgive student loan debt. No, you know, I paid mine off. For all those folks, this is one of those really interesting graphs. Back in the mid-70s, Pell Grants covered 80% of the share of a cost of tuition and room and board and all that stuff. The maximum Pell Grant was 80%. As they pointed out, 2016-2017 year, about 30%. There's a huge difference between what my generation paid, which, you know, I went to school in the 80s. It was about 45%, still going down, but not where it is today. Like I said, in the 30% range. Crazy. Massive redistribution of wealth, saddling a generation with massive debt. And I'm hoping the president does something. I'm hoping it happens soon. Because, look, we need it. Absolutely need it. But I got to tell you, I love our friends over at the Center for American Progress. Very optimistic folks they are, because they've got a report on what to do once Joe Biden does cancel student loan debt. And share some thoughts on what should be done once he does that. I've asked Jared Bass to come talk with us. Jared is the senior director of education policy there at the Center for American Progress. Jared, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Love your optimism. Love the fact that you think, hey, it's going to get done. And now we got to move on and start preparing for the day after. Are we sure it's going to get done?
Yeah, we're very, very hopeful. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons that we wanted to call it after is just to hammer home the point that this is something that the president has been talking about. He said he would make a decision before the moratorium on student loan payments, you know, was scheduled to end. You know, August 31st is the, you know, last date that we have in mind. Of course, the president can extend it again if he wants to, and we're hoping he does, and that he would make a decision on debt cancellation ahead of that time. You know, we believe it's the right time to consider such a bold, progressive approach to, you know, student loan relief. And, you know, the time is right. It's right now. So we put together a package of just suggestions and recommendations for the president, for Congress to consider once a decision is made, to make sure that we aren't in this situation again. You know, you talked about some of the generational issues and concerns. We don't want the burden of educational opportunity to come with a price tag that is so, so high that people can't really, you know, achieve economic opportunity from having a college degree.
No, and this is one of those things where, you know, I've heard people say, oh, we need debt forgiveness, we need reform, you know, all of those words, like, you know, somehow you're doing something out of the goodness of your heart. When the reality is I think it's about fairness. What we've done to this generation is downright criminal. And I look at this information that John sent from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, this, and it's you can't refute this. You know, the generation that went to school back in the 70s, their tuition was covered, heavily subsidized by taxpayer money. And yet this generation, well, get some skin in the game, Jared. Take out those loans. Invest in yourself. That kind of corporate BS that saddled them with what are we up to? Almost $1.5 trillion, $2 trillion in debt.
Yeah, $1.6 trillion in federal student loan debt alone. Even higher if we talk about private student loan debt, for sure. You know, and one of the things we talked about in the report is actually institutions having skin in the game. You know, students have had enough skin in the game when it comes to student loans, when it comes to educational, you know, how to pay for higher education. We want institutions to make sure they're paying into the system, that we are controlling college costs that have, you know, outpaced the inflation for quite some time, for decades and decades. And so, yeah, it is a question of fairness. One of the things that we point out in the report, you know, after President Biden cancels debt, that, you know, $85 billion was provided for student loans for new loan volume. That's, you know, for anyone taking out a student loan to go to college, you know, grad school, $85 billion. That was more than Pell Grants, work study, and, you know, a supplemental grant program for higher education combined. And, you know, student loans account for 67%, you know, fiscal year 2022 of all federal student assistance. And so there is an over-reliance on student loans. We need to make sure that that changes. We need to make sure that the number one form of federal assistance coming out, you know, or coming to students is actually in the form of grants, that it's not loans, that it's grants that, you know, paving the way for educational opportunity and economic opportunity for students.
Yeah, I mean, those numbers are just crazy. I mean, that's just It's no way to run a country. I mean, if an educated workforce is what we're going to need to compete in the 21st century, if this is what's going to make us competitive, I'm sorry, saddling people with massive debt that they're never going to get out from under, I don't know if that's the best way to be competitive. You know, or am I missing something?
I don't think you're missing anything at all. So it's interesting, and this is well before my time, I have to say this. But I think it was 1958 when Sputnik launched, sometime in the 50s. The response to that was actually, we need to educate people. So they created the National Defense Education Act, which created one of the first, forms of federal assistance, mass forms of federal assistance, and was really about preserving, economic, scientific leadership in the United States, because we did not want to be eclipsed by another nation. We took this approach, and, the legacy of that lives on through so many generations. And, my mom talked about being a beneficiary of, one of the federal forms of assistance in that act just recently. And so I think, for that framing, national defense, thinking about, competitive advantage, thinking about the legacy of the United States and current day as well. And, the future, too, it really should include higher education. It really should be a strategic priority, to really just leverage and preserve our strategic positioning in, the global economy, but also just in world leadership.
Why don't we frame it like that? I mean, why aren't we talking about, education in those terms instead of where it's been, skin in the game, you want a middle class existence, invest in yourself. Why aren't we talking about it in terms of a national strategy to compete globally, to be able to have an educated workforce, to be able to compete in the 21st century and beyond? And why aren't we doing that?
I think there's just this focus on what divides us instead of what can unite us. The one thing I just want to point out with student loan debt cancellation is that you have unions, you have folks, who are, term blue collar workers coming out in support of debt cancellation because it benefits them. Folks who, may be blue collar, but went to college, you have to get a skill. But also, when we think about, the pandemic that we're currently in, when we think about healthcare, we want trained professionals, we want doctors, we want researchers, we want people to develop those cures that we, so badly need. And the higher education is part of that, So I do hope that we start to frame it that way. I do hope that we start to frame it as an issue that is important for our global leadership. I also hope that we frame it as an issue that isn't just like, a left-leaning issue, and I think that's some of the rhetoric that we hear from some of our friends in Congress. Look, to be clear, Democrats have student loan debt. Republicans have student loan debt. Independents have student loan debt. They don't just give you debt because you sign up for a political affiliation or political party. You have debt regardless because you need it to, go to college, you get a college degree.
Yep.
So this really should be an issue that everyone's invested in because it affects so many from, across the political spectrum.
Yeah, but again, they play on our divides and say, well, I paid mine. Why should they get a free ride? And you look at the reality is this generation certainly not getting a free ride. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Jared Bass, Senior Director of Education Policy at the Center for American Progress. If you want to check out their work, AmericanProgress.org, the website, we'll get links out on social media. You can check out their report on what the president and what the country should be doing after the president cancels student loan debt. So let's say that he does it. Let's say tomorrow he wipes it all out, not just the $10,000 or the $50,000, but it goes the whole enchilada and it's all gone. What's the first thing we should be doing? Because my concern in this has always been, let's say he does wipe it all out. We've picked this generation as winners. My kids, when they go to college here in a couple of years, they may not be in the winner class. They're going to get saddled with the same student loan debt because structurally, we haven't changed any of the dynamics yet.
Exactly. So we want to attack that structure. We want to make the structural reforms. You touched on it at the top of the top of the segment. We need to be increasing the Pell Grant, increasing funding for the Pell Grant. There are proposals out there right now. The president has a proposal to double the Pell Grant, to double funding, get back to those historic numbers of coverage. And we're talking about purchasing power of the Pell Grant by 2029. So he has a plan to do that. That's something that we should do. We should also not just be giving aid out to colleges. We also need to make sure that they have skin in the game. We talked about this, already, and making sure that they're paying into the system, make sure we're, controlling college costs. One way we can do that is through free community college or free college. The president has a proposal for that as well. That, you know, those are the types of things that I think will make sure that we have an affordable higher education, not just for our current generation, but for generations to come. We also need accountability. This is key. So we need aid, we need to control college costs, but we also need to hold colleges accountable for poor outcomes, for low quality degrees, for an education that's not going to actually benefit them, where they, you know, earn less than they would have if they never went to that college to begin with.
Yeah.
Those are the sorts of things that we should be addressing, and also broader reforms to the student loan system too.
No, I mean, there's a part of me that goes, you know, I'm against privatization, especially when you're looking at education. I look at what's happened to higher education as we've allowed these for-profit universities to come and basically suck, you know, just tax dollars dry, especially when you're looking at GI money and you're looking at, you know, some of the student loan stuff and some of the predatory practices that have gone on. And I think that really has to be addressed more than anything, because I think most people are like, look, you know, they're making it sound so easy and so convenient. And then you end up with a piece of paper that ends up at the bottom of the birdcage.
You know, it's sad, but you really have to use caveat emptor as a slogan, you know, these days, or as a moniker, just buyer beware, because, you know, that's not the case for so many students. You know, we're seeing that now where the president had to forgive a huge swath of student loan debt for borrowers who were misled by their colleges over at Corinthian through borrower defense. You know, the president is trying to put back in place regulations that the Trump administration, you know, took out or tried to do away with as far as gainful employment, making sure that, you know, students who attended a for-profit college or university or, you know, career-oriented program actually could, you know, achieve what that program said they were going to achieve, which is gainful employment. And those are the sorts of things that we need to do. We need to be controlling for-profit institutions and then also undercover for-profit institutions. And, you know, this new thing of online program managers or providers who are for-profit companies who contract with colleges and universities, but still, you know, just, you know, take advantage of universities and students and taxpayer dollars. And that's something that we need to curb as well. So that's why accountability is key, in addition to controlling college costs and also increasing grant aid. And, you know, those three reforms, or those three categories of reforms, will really help us right the system to make sure that we are serving students well into the future.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this, because there's the other part of the loan situation. Let's say Biden cancels all the loans that he can. There's still all of the private loans. And I have a young relative who, you know, recently told me she's like $100,000 in debt. A good number of those loans are private loans. So no matter what Biden does, not going to help her an awful lot, because there's a lot of those private loans that, you know, she's stuck with. And there are no bankruptcy protections to where if something happens and she can't pay, you know, she's stuck with this till death does she part. Is there something you can do in that world? Do we pursue bringing back bankruptcy protections for people? What do we do on that side of the ledger then?
So I have to tell you, so the CFPB, has been doing work in this department. So while the Department of Education handles, you know, federal loans, the CFPB has been, you know, really going after private lending, especially in this space. You know, that's one. Bankruptcy reforms are another. And, you know, I think that there are some people making some headways there to make sure that private student loan debt does not become a life sentence, that there are, you know, protections there for people as well. But, you know, really looking to consumer advocacy and the consumer system and strengthening that system, you know, will help private, you know, student loan borrowers, you know, who have debt currently. I think the other thing is just, you know, making sure that information gets out there for people to be aware of, you know, the federal option and the federal alternative, because even though there's still student loan debt there, they do, you know, the federal government does provide more favorable terms and options and repayment programs for people to take advantage of, you know, such as this moratorium that we have right now on federal student loans, which has, you know, been a great relief and a great, you know, help to students and borrowers. You know, the other thing that folks can do is, you know, when they, you know, suspect, you know, foul play with their servicing of their private loans, report that to the CFPB. Because they would love to hear from them, love to take a look, and love to, you know, be part of the conversation to right any wrongs that are happening there.
I mean, I got to be honest, you know, when I went to college out of high school, I didn't have the money, and you know, I decided not to take on massive loans because I'm really, really afraid. And even then, back then, it wasn't as bad as it is today. So I can't imagine what kids are being saddled with today. And it shouldn't be this difficult. I mean, we should have an education system that moves people through as far as their talents and their abilities take them, not for as deep as their pockets are.
I wholeheartedly agree. And, you know, that's the system. That's the higher education system that the Center for American Progress wants to build. That's the one that we want to help create, and that's the one that we want to encourage.
There you go. If you want to check out the work that Jared and the folks over at the Center for American Progress do, AmericanProgress.org, the website. We'll get links out on social media. You can check out this most recent report. Jared, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Good stuff as always. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff, Jared Bass. He is the Senior Director there of Education Policy at the Center for American Progress. Again, make sure you check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. Love to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, podcast, wherever you get yours, you'll find ours. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1981. It was a dark day in U.S. labor history. Nearly 13,000 members of the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization had been out on strike for 2 days. At issue were working conditions and hours. More than 6,000 flights were canceled on the first day of the strike alone. President Ronald Reagan held a press conference at the White House's Rose Garden to address the work stoppage. He declared that the strike constituted a peril to national safety. He also announced that strikes by federal workers were illegal. Although this was technically true, federal workers had participated in more than 20 strikes and sickouts in the years leading up to the Patco walkout. Yet President Reagan seized on the opportunity to bust the union. And in what has been called the shot heard round the boardroom, he announced that every Patco worker that did not return to work within 48 hours would be fired. He made good on his promise, and more than 11,000 air traffic controllers lost their jobs. The president also decreed that the strikers could never be rehired. By October, the Federal Labor Relations Authority had decertified the union. President Reagan's actions had a chilling impact on the labor movement. Before Patco, there were 300 major strikes on average in the United States each year. Afterwards, that number dropped to 30. 3 decades after the decision, Joseph McCartin, a professor at Georgetown University, described the impact in a New York Times article, writing, "More than any other labor dispute of the past 3 decades. Reagan's confrontation with the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, or PATCO, undermined the bargaining power of American workers and their labor unions." Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. RickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? Email me at Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you know, I look at this, and again, our student loan situation is really, you know, I keep coming back to, I use the word criminal. What we've done to a generation is criminal. You know, I go back to when I was in school, and look, the loans that I would have had to take out were like $4,000 or $5,000 a year. As I remember it. And I was just not, I wasn't willing to do it because it just seemed like such an enormous amount of money. And I had the option. I was fortunate enough. I got a union job that really paid incredibly well, more than I would have made, with a degree, to be honest. So I had that option. Sadly, that's not so mature. And during the break, I was thinking about this kid that I met, a number of years ago. Back, I guess it would have been 2011, in the summer, springish summer of 2011, when then Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett was talking about slashing the higher ed budget in this state in half, because that's what Republicans do. They slash education budget. In fact, that's what the current Republican nominee running for governor here in this state is talking about doing, slashing education in half. Because, well, we don't need an educated populace. You know, we need people just smart enough to, well, as George Carlin said, smart enough to do the work and smart enough to push the buttons, but not smart enough to realize that they're getting screwed over. But I remember at the time, as you know, I was waiting for my turn to go and give my little song and dance and speak before the rally. I met a kid who was just standing there holding the sign. And we struck up a conversation, and he was telling me the story of his life and why he was there. And, you know, we were going through this, and, you know, he said his grandfather had always wanted to go to college and couldn't because of, you know, one thing or another. The old-fashioned reason, usually. Grandma got pregnant and had to go to the mill to get a job. So he didn't get to go. And then the father wanted to go to college, but, hey, Vietnam called. And, then, you know, the old-fashioned reason, you know, the older brothers and older sisters came along and, you know, went to the mill to get a job. You know, good union job, good wages, good benefits, led a very solid middle-class life. He said, you know, I'm the first in my family to go to college. This is my only choice. This is my only chance. This is my only opportunity. And I said, well, why? He goes, because the mill's not there. There's no plan B. There's no fallback. There's no, hey, I can go back and work at the mill and do as well as my parents and my grandparents. And that's what we've done to a generation, a couple of generations of workers in this country. We've given them no options and said, hey, the only way for you to get into the middle class, the only way for you to lead a solid middle class existence is to invest in yourself, stake in, you know, a little skin in the game. And so heap yourself with massive amounts of debt, and then maybe, no guarantees, maybe you'll get that golden ticket. And I remember this was beginning when I was in high school, because they were saying, oh, you know, all the, you know, the deindustrialization was really just ramping up, and we were losing factories, and, you know, trucking companies were going out of business because of deregulation, and, you know, Reagan's high dollar policies were just crushing manufacturing in this country. As we were just being killed by imports. And we were told, you know, you need to get into the knowledge economy. And, you know, Reagan was like, you know, we're going to get rid of the dirty manufacturing and we're going to all have corner, wear white shirts, ties, corner offices. It's going to be great. Service sectors. Yes. Service economy jobs. It's going to be great. Not asking the question, you know, what kind of service sector jobs? You want fries with that? That's a service sector job. It doesn't pay very well. I'll wash your dog, you wash my windows. That's not really an economy to build prosperity on. You need to take things and turn them into things. You need to have productive capacity. And we gave that away. And you go, no, but Rick, you know, we're better off because, you know, remember economics class, you know, rice and beans, the ones who have the best productivity and the best, you know, resources, you know, that. And what you ended up with is you ended up with rich people going, hey, there's a way to exploit labor and exploit the environment and do all the things that they've done to enrich themselves while sticking it to the working people. And that kid, you know, that kid that was there in on that day, you know, holding a sign, hoping that they would be able to stave off the massive cuts that he wasn't going to be able to shoulder. He said, look, I'm already at the end of my financial rope. I can't take out any more loans. I don't have any more income. My parents can't afford any more to give me. This is it. If they raise the tuition, if they cut state funding, I'm screwed. And he was just one kid, and there were hundreds there in the same kind of situation. And, you know, look, the wealth class of this country, they've always done well. They're always going to do well. It's the working class that ends up with these kind of, oh, skin in the game kind of arguments, who end up getting the shaft. And by having these tax breaks for corporations and the wealthy policies, because this is what happened. This is a massive redistribution of wealth. A massive redistribution of wealth from, well, you to them. And the question is, when do we finally say enough? When do we finally say, nope, it's time for you to pay more in taxes like previous generations? Because when Reagan took office, the tax rate in this country was still 70% on the ultra wealthy. we still had a higher corporate tax rate. And yet you got Kirsten Dipsy Do Cinema going, I don't know, 15% seems high. It's time to start taxing the rich. That simple. Not because we're jealous, but because we need the investment. That simple. Love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Also, miss any of the program, grab the podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media.